20 years ago, David Millark, a northern Michigan nurseryman with a penchant for a hard living, had a vision. Angels came to him and told him that the earth was in trouble. Its trees were dying, and without them, human life was in jeopardy. The solution, they told him, was to clone the champion trees of the world, the largest, the hardiest, the ones that had survived millennia and were most resilient to climate change, and create a kind of Noah's Ark of tree genetics. Without knowing if the message had any basis in science or why he'd been chosen for the task, Millark sent out on his mission of cloning the world's great trees. Many scientists and tree experts told him it couldn't be done, but 20 years later, his team has successfully cloned some of the world's oldest trees, among them giant redwoods and sequoias. They've also grown seedlings from the oldest tree in the world, the bristlecone pine Methuselah. When New York Times journalist Jim Robbins came upon Millark's story, he was fascinated, but had his doubts. Yet over several years listening to Millark and talking to scientists, he came to realize that there is so much we do not yet know about trees. His new book is The Man Who Planted Trees, Lost Grove, Champion Trees, and an Urgent Plan to Save the Planet. Jim Robbins, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
I thank you for spending the time. What did you make of the story when you initially came upon it?
Well, the first story I wrote about this was without knowing the backstory about the near-death experience. It was in 2001. It ran in the science section of the Times. And I thought it was a great plan just to clone the largest tree of every species to protect, to make a 100% copy of each of those trees, a genetic copy, so those genetics would be preserved in case they had something important in them for the survival of future forests and future trees. And then a year later, I met Millark here in Montana where I live, and he told me the story about the near-death experience and this vision that he had, and I was a little incredulous. But I also knew from talking to scientists that there was something going on with trees. And then a couple years later, I have 15 acres of forested property in Montana. I should say had, because over the next few years, virtually every tree that we have was killed by bark beetles, and we had to cut them all down. And I realized there was something going on. I mean, we've had warmer weather here than we've ever had. I've been here 30 years. It doesn't get below zero in the winter very often at all anymore. It used to for 3 weeks at a time. And the bugs are simply living longer, and they're much longer in the summer, and they're able to kill more trees. And then I started reporting on other die-offs, from the bristlecone pines to Canadian Rockies. Trees are dying all over the American West, and it's very unsettling.
When you look at the of how unsettling that is and the trees dying off, one of the points of the book and in Millark's work and a conclusion he comes to, a conclusion you come to, and as I mentioned in the introduction, that there is so much that we don't know yet about trees. And those question marks are really, I guess, what kept him on this quest, isn't it?
Yeah, and kept me on my quest. That's true. I mean, we simply don't know. We don't know what's in tree genetics. They've sequenced the genes of a lot of different cash crops, but trees, by and large, aren't a cash crop. And so there are a couple of trees that have had their genes sequenced, but no one knows what those genes represent. And all the other trees were just simply guessing. And so it made a lot of sense. I mean, I looked at his idea from every angle, and it made a lot of sense not knowing about these things. It made sense to protect these genetics because they could well, I mean, the argument is, well, maybe these trees were lucky, or maybe they got more water in a microclimate or something,
right,
these champion trees, but no one really knows.
So the scientists say it can't be done. So how was David Millark able to do it then?
Well, you know, he's a shade tree farmer, and he always says he's stubborn, and he learned. He had a steep learning curve coming out of a rural area and into the cities to try and raise money and get his project funded, and he enlisted the help of scientists, eminent scientists in some cases, to help him do this and to support his work, And his passion for this really helped, and he found some funders along the way here and there, and then a few years ago found a woman who really put the project over the top to do it the way that he'd hoped to do it. And I just talked to someone there yesterday at the Ancient Tree Archive in Michigan, and they said they've archived more than 60 different species of tree, including 18 different oak trees from champion oak trees from Ireland, and they're growing those now, and so things are well underway.
His current projects include cloning and growing the ancient coast redwoods and the giant sequoias. With that information, I mean, what once you have completed it, then what? What is the next logical step?
Well, the next logical step is to continue the collection. He wants to do a 100-tree collection of the 100 oldest trees. But the next logical step, I guess the logical step for him or the logical step for us as a culture, I mean, I think for him he'd like to see these giants, these champions, get planted out amongst others of their kind, so these genetics are part of the mix. In a forest of 1,000 planted redwoods, for example, you might plant one or two champions. And but for us as a culture, as a civilization, I think that it's time to pay attention to what's going on. I mean, if it gets, we have all seen what's happened here this spring, how early it came, how hot it's gotten so early. And there's a real concern about the trees. We've seen it here in the West. Trees are dying all around us. And I think it's time to pay attention and figure out what we might do. I think planting trees is one of those things. I think planting trees by ourselves or with a community. I think trying to figure out some of the science of what's going on it should be a big part of this. And so I think that it's time to think about the trees.
Planting trees, and what trees to plant, though?
That's a big question. I'm not sure I have the answer to that. I think the best thing, if you wanted to plant a tree now, would be to go to your landscape store or wherever you get your trees, a community tree group or something, and ask them, what do I plant? Usually it's a native tree, hardy, something that's going to survive. I mean, I don't think going to Walmart or discount stores is the way to go when you're buying a tree. Survivability is a big question when it comes to trees, and I think you want to take the best tree possible and put it in the ground and make sure that it has the best chance for survival.
We always hear of trees in a very sturdy sense of the mighty oak, but in this book we realize just how fragile they are, a fragility that I didn't really realize.
And I think they're becoming more fragile as it gets warmer. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, the bristlecones, the oldest trees in the world, are dying. What does that tell you when they've lasted for 4,000 years or 5,000 years, and suddenly in the last year or two, they're starting to die, and experts say they will all die? So these trees are fragile. They can't evolve as fast as their enemies can. A fungal disease or an insect can evolve very quickly over a matter of years. But a tree takes many lifetimes, and of course those lifetimes are often long, so they're at a disadvantage that way. And I think that one of the things that David at Millark is saying and others is that we need to help them because they're at a disadvantage, especially as the climate gets warmer.
And as the climate gets warmer, is that what is bringing these enemies to the front?
Yeah, I mean, I've talked with climate scientists who say, you know, the average increase in temperature in the American West is 2 degrees over the last 50 years. But on the mountaintops, it's 15 to 20 degrees warmer during the winter when it would get the coldest. It's 15 to 20 degrees warmer, and it's incredible. And so what that means is it's not getting cold enough anymore to kill the insects, and they're just living through in unprecedented numbers. I did a story a few weeks ago on a study that shows that sometimes in some places these insects are having two generations per year, which is again unheard of. So the climate change is changing our planet, but at the same time we've fragmented and stressed our forests to the point where they're very susceptible because of both of these problems.
Jim Robbins is a frequent contributor to the science section of the New York Times. His new book is The Man Who Planted Trees, Lost Grove, Champion Trees, and An Urgent Plan to Save the Planet. Jim, I thank you very much for sharing David Millarc's story, and I thank you very much for being with us and sharing your insights as well.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Great. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.